You're listening to New Voices, a production of the Extending New Narratives in the History of Philosophy project.
This podcast is sponsored by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada and partner institutions.
I'm Olivia Branscombe.
And I'm Haley Brennan.
In this episode, I talked to Huaping Liu Adler, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Georgetown University, about her new book, Kant, Race, and Racism, Views from Somewhere. In the course of our conversation, we talk about what it means to philosophize from a particular perspective, about the compatibility of Kant's moral theory and his racist claims, about the ways that our contemporary philosophical canon has its origin in Kant's writings, and about the importance of community for philosophical work.
My name is Huaping Liu Adler. I'm an associate professor of philosophy at Georgetown University. I mainly work on Kant and history of Western philosophy from 17th to 18th century. I also have a substantive interest in classical Chinese philosophy, history and philosophy of science, philosophy of race, and social epistemology.
So our conversation today is going to focus primarily on your recent book, Kant, Race, and Racism, Views from Somewhere. So I actually want to start by asking you about this subtitle, Views from Somewhere. What is a view from somewhere? What does it mean to you to offer a view from somewhere? And how does that play a role in the book and in your philosophy?
Great. That's a great question. The original title, main title of the book, was The View from Somewhere, and then Kant, Race, and Racism was the subtitle. But the editor, for marketing reason, wanted me to flip the two. I think that was a good decision, because I think this makes the main subject a little bit more salient. That being said, I think it's really important for me to emphasize that, you know, we look at the world always from a particular standpoint. But often we don't take that simple fact seriously enough, especially in professional philosophy. You know, we have this pretension to view from nowhere, right? As though we don't occupy any standpoint. So basically, the subtitle is meant to capture, for me, a very simple idea that we always philosophize from a particular viewpoint. And this viewpoint is often shaped by our own lived experiences, our cultures, values, our social locations, and our professionalizations, and all these kind of things. So the three parts of this book, in a way, are structured around this idea. So part one is talking about the viewpoint from which interpreters, especially Kant scholars, tend to evaluate Kant's racial views. And then part two mainly looks at the standpoint from which Kant himself developed a systematic theory of race. And then part three looks at the modern worldview that, in my view, has been irrevocably shaped by the racial categories that Kant helped to establish and propagate. So that's the sense in which the subtitle shapes the structure of the book. But there's also an important dimension of the book that's not particularly explicit, but it's a kind of, I would say, my own viewpoint shapes the overall tenor of the book. So this is the place where I would say it's important for me that I'm writing as, say, a woman of color, or what they would call in the United States a woman of color, even though I would specifically say I'm Chinese. And so as people who are familiar with some aspects of Kant's racial thinking would know that Kant constantly denigrated, you know, the so-called yellow race. So I would see myself in this. And so I think it's kind of really important for me to think about how I'm moving through this project and what kind of values I'm bringing into this. And so during the process of writing this book, I thought a lot about my own values and my own upbringing, and thought about the way in which I deal with difficult subject. And so I would say my upbringing was a mixture of Confucianism, Taoism, and Buddhism. And so people who read the book carefully will notice that I never called Kant a racist. And that's actually really, really important to me. It's not just a strategic reason, but there is a deep Buddhist principle behind this decision. Because as one of my students put it last semester in my Chinese philosophy class, in Buddhist tradition, or you don't describe people by adjectives, but you talk about them by verbs. So you look at what they do without, you know, attributing some fixed characteristic to them. And so that's the kind of, I want to kind of put it, clarify this up front, that I never call Kant racist. And that's actually a really important principle decision that has a lot to do with my cultural background. And I want to approach this topic with a lot of grace. And I always call this project, like on the side, I never said it in the book, but when I tell people about the project, I always say, this is my truth and reconciliation with Kant. And the reconciliation part is really, really important. And my emphasis on the reconciliation part also has a lot to do with my Buddhist background. Again, I try to approach this project with a lot of grace to basically everyone, including myself. Yeah.
Can you tell me a bit more about this book as a reconciliation project, your own reconciliation, and then perhaps scholarship's reconciliation with Kant's racist statements?
Yeah, that is a great question. So let me begin with myself. So I can tell you a little bit about how I actually got started and got interested in this project, because I think that in a way answers part of your question. So I got my PhD in 2012, and I wrote my dissertation on Kant's philosophy of logic. And I got tenured in 2018, and that was also the year when my first book came out on Kant's philosophy of logic. But until that time, I was completely, completely ignorant about Kant's views on race. I used to feel really ashamed by this, but then now I think there might be some bigger reason behind my ignorance. So the year I became interested in this topic was 2019. It was all serendipity. So there was this fascinating session called Prejudice in Philosophy. And the main speakers were Charles Mills and Robert Bernasconi, and Lucia Lay was the commentator. So I did not know anything about those scholars' writings on Kant's racism. So you can say, you know, that kind of secondary literature was all hidden in plain sight, but for whatever reason, I did not know anything about that. And so I went to that session with a hope to know more about prejudices in our profession more generally. But much of the discussion ended up revolving around Kant's racism for understandable reasons. And so you can imagine my shock or even grief, right, after that session. And so I actually went through a serious intellectual or even moral crisis about Kant, because now I kind of felt that, you know, what I'm gonna do, right? Here's someone I work on, and he said all these things. What do I do? But as the cliche goes, the best way out is through. So I decided to help myself out by moving through this whole thing and really getting to the bottom of it. And I realized that I could not just walk away from this part of Kant's work because I knew that I would do so with resentment. And I did not want to have any resentment in my heart. And so I decided that I should just be patient and work through some of this this material. And I tried to practice a lot of, say, self-love, because, you know, it was hard to see myself or my so-called race being denigrated in Kant's writings. But I decided again to say that, you know, I want to walk through all this stuff and then come out of the other side with a deeper understanding, with a lot of patience, and with a lot of grace. And so that's why I ended up with this view that I'm not just here to tell you the truth about Kant's views on race, but this truth-telling has an important purpose, which is reconciliation. Now, what does that reconciliation look like or should look like? I don't want to prescribe anything to my fellow Kant scholars. That's why I kind of, in a way, the forward-looking conclusion of the book is a call for my fellow scholars to join me in this process of reconciliation. One thing is clear to me, namely, you cannot just dance around it. You have to face it, and you have to think really honestly and really hard about this topic. And everybody may find a different way to reconcile with Kant, but I think the task itself is important.
So I would love to get into some of the details, or I guess the main claims of the book. But just before we turn to that, in thinking through how you got started on this project, you mentioned that you've only been thinking about working on this topic, Kant's theories of race, since 2019.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Your book is such a comprehensive account, not only of the details of Kant's views and positions, but also of philosophical theories of race throughout the 18th and 19th centuries. Mm-hmm. So how did you go from a first introduction to the topic 4 years ago now to writing this book?
I think when I introduced myself, I kind of hinted at the fact that I was actually quite prepared for this kind of project, even though you may not see any kind of straightforward connection between what I did before and then what I was doing with this book. So I was getting seriously interested in history and philosophy of science. And so I think that prepared me for working on Kant's theory of race, because even though a lot of people who talk about Kant's racist views tend to focus on his moral philosophy, and I think there was not much of a deep dive into why Kant became interested in the topic of race in the first place. And I think I was actually quite well positioned to see that, given my interest in philosophy of science. And not just philosophy, science, you know, in abstraction, right, independently of the historical context of its development. So I was interested in the history of science as well. And so I think that prepared me to write chapters 3 and 4, where I focus on Kant's position as a natural philosopher. And so that was actually my entry point. So when I was preparing to write the book, I also wrote some articles. This is how I actually typically operate when I write a book. So I would write a couple of articles and send them to top journals. And then I would get really helpful feedback. And some of that feedback actually completely reshaped my book. So for example, my article on Kant on savagery, which was later published at the Journal of History and Philosophy, I think that article went through 2 rounds of revisions, and both referees gave me really, really helpful feedback. And one of them pressed me in particular to take a stance on the question that Charles Mills raised, namely whether there is a contradiction between Kant's moral philosophy and his racist views. And so that basically, you know, forced me to think through some of these issues. And that's how the book, you know, became the way it is today. And so, yeah, I would say I worked out the pieces both thanks to my own background training in history and philosophy of science, but also thanks to the kind of feedback I've received along the way. Very honest, very demanding, and very challenging feedback I received along the way. So they helped me to see things in a systematic way. Yeah.
You briefly mentioned one of your main claims in the book, and I want to come back to that. So the claim is this, that there is no direct contradiction between Kant's moral theory on the one hand and his racist remarks and theorizing on the other. Just a little bit of background for our listeners. Kant quite famously espouses what most people take to be a universal moral theory, which is to say that morality and moral considerations apply equally to all people across the board. But at the same time, and this is the topic of Hua-Ping's book and of many articles on the subject, Kant makes racist claims or statements in several of his published texts. So an assumption that has animated a lot of scholarship on these racist statements is that they are inconsistent with Kant's universal moral theory. You argue, on the other hand, that there is at least no direct contradiction between Kant's racism and his moral theory. You say, and this is I guess not quite a direct quote, more of a close paraphrase, but that his philosophy is capacious enough to incorporate both elements. So can you first tell me just exactly how you characterize the apparent contradiction? And then why you don't find this contradiction in Kant's thoughts, what it means that his philosophy can accommodate both elements.
In the book, I use Charles Mills' characterization of the contradiction, right? As you said, on the one hand, at least in theory, Kant seems to espouse this moral universalism, which Charles Mills describes as the proposition that, you know, say the formula of humility, right, has this unrestricted scope of application. And what's in the scope of application is all the set, right, entire set of all biological human beings, right? So that's supposed to be what's on the one hand. On the other hand, there is what Charles Mills calls racist particularism, right, according to which Blacks, for example, are destined to be used as means, namely slaves, right? So if you put it that way, it looks like, well, there is a logical contradiction here. And so what do you do when you get a logical contradiction? You take a side, right? You decide what you're going to do about this contradiction, right? So then that's how the scholars who have debated about Kant's racist views are divided into two camps, right? On the one hand, you have those people who are like Charles Mills, who insisted that, you know, we should pay close attention to Kant's racist views and should reinterpret, right, his moral theory in light of his racist views, and to say that, you know, his moral theory, in essence, or in practice at least, is not universalist, right? And then on the other hand, you have most Kant scholars who have taken a stance on this topic. They will say, well, they'll just bite the bullet, right? And they'll say, well, Kant said all these racist things, but that's just his personal prejudice. But his philosophy, his core moral theory is still good. And namely, it's universalist. So I here play the good old Kant scholar, like my late advisor, Henry Allison. And I would really want to dig into Kant's text and see what's there. And I think a lot of interpreters of Kant's moral philosophy today projected their own liberal values onto Kant too quickly. And the way they read Kant's, say, universal moral claims is to say, immediately to say, right, these moral claims are generalizable to all existing human beings. And so I want to say, well, that's not really Kant. And so you mentioned my description of Kant's system as capacious. So here I want to say, that cloud system is not only capacious, but has so many layers that can't carefully separates, right? So what's relevant to my argument is that there are three levels of discourse represented by three different disciplines. So at the most abstract level, you have Kant's pure moral philosophy that's represented by the groundwork of the metaphysics of morals. And then the next level, which is less abstract, but still somewhat abstract, is his pragmatic anthropology. And then at the lowest level, the most concrete level, is his physical geography. So what I argue is that it's true that racism does not show up at the most abstract level, but it's not because, you know, Kant's pure moral philosophy is itself inclusive, but it's only because Kant's pure moral philosophy has nothing to do with concrete human beings at all. So this has to do with how you understand Kant's concept of human being. So Kant has different understandings of the concept of human being at different levels of discourse, right? At, you know, again, at the most abstract level, at the level of pure moral philosophy, the concept of human being is a stand-in for the concept of finite rational agency. So as such, has nothing to do with concretely embodied human beings at all. And as Henry Allison put it, does not even have to do with human species. So Kant can claim at that very abstract level, right, make some of these universalistic claims without thereby committing himself to saying that all concretely embodied human beings have exactly the same moral standing. So if you look at where his racist claims show up, you'll see they're mostly in the kind of combined area of pragmatic anthropology and physical geography. You know, if you read Kant this way, you'll see that his more pure moral philosophy and his anthropology and physical geography, which is where his, you know, racist claims show up, belong to very different levels of discourse. And so that's what I mean, that there can be no straightforward contradiction between the two. And so Kant has all this space for him to say all these kind of things without contradicting himself. As I said earlier, I tell the truth so that I can reckon with Kant. So I just told you the truth, what I take to be the true truth about Kant's views. I gave this reading, this is something I talk about in the conclusion. You may think that this picture of Kant is very damning, right? So he comes out as this like consistent racist, right? That is true. But for me, if I take a step back, I also find something very attractive in a way that's different from how a lot of Kant scholars find him attractive. I read him as a non-ideal philosopher because of his attention. I think Kant was a very shrewd observer of the world around him. That's not the picture of Kant we typically get, right? Typically, we picture him as this abstract thinker, this armchair philosopher. But Kant was very interested, obviously, right? From the fact that he taught physical geography for four decades, right? Suggested that he was a very worldly philosopher. And he said this as much, right? So I see him as someone who paid very, very close attention to how the world, the actual world, is unfolding around him. And he was very interested in understanding the dynamics of that very concrete world. And he wanted to see the philosophical relevance of that information. And if you put it this way, I think there's still something for us to learn from Kant. I don't think, you know, as far as we want to philosophize in a way that aims at wisdom, right? Not just a speculative knowledge. If you want to aim at the kind of philosophical knowledge that can allow you to engage with the world and maybe even change the world in a way, I think we should be like Kant and pay attention to what's going on around us, especially like social, cultural, and political dynamics. Of course, we can say that Kant, you know, got that bit wrong, but it does not mean that his very attention to what's going on around the world is wrong. Yeah.
One concrete example you offer in the book of the broad scale philosophical relevance of Kant's attention to the real world and his understanding of racial categories in particular is how Kant's account of who gets to count as a proper philosopher has informed who we teach and study in philosophy to this day.
Yeah.
So can you talk a bit about your argument that our current Eurocentric canon has its origins in Kant's writings?
Yeah, great. That's another great and important question, and also a tricky one, because it's never easy to establish direct causal connection, right, between, you know, what somebody said in the past and our practices today, right? So there must be a lot of factors, right? That's why I never interpret Kant in isolation, right? I always put him in this like historically extended, right, historical trajectory of how racial perceptions happen and how, you know, racial thinking shaped our institutions and things like that. So that being said, I think I have enough basis to conclude that Kant was the first to clearly articulate the theoretical justification for a Western Eurocentric view of the history of philosophy, and for the Western Eurocentric canon that has shaped today's professional philosophy. Here's my reason. So if you look at, I mean, this is something that I learned from Peter Park's really important work, right? Africa, Asia, and the History of Philosophy, Racism in the Formation of the Philosophical Canon, 1780 to 1830, right? So that was Peter Park's book, first published in 2013. So as you can learn from Peter Park's very careful historical analysis, what was happening before Kant intervened in the debate about the origin of philosophy was that the prevailing view at that time was that philosophy originated in the East, right? People were just debating about whether it was Egypt or India, right? But the prevailing view was that it was, you know, from the East. And also another philosophically relevant point is that people before Kant had this conception of history as some form of descriptive storytelling. So they use the concept historia, right? And the historia is a descriptive project. And so they did not have an a priori conception of how exactly you have to tell the history, right? They did not have an a priori conception of what history ought to look like. Now, so when Kant came in, I think Kant's most important philosophical contribution and conceptual contribution in this regard was his reconceptualization of history, right? So Kant introduced this new philosophical concept of history called Geschichte, right? For him, Geschichte is not just about how, you know, history actually unfolded in space and time, rather it's a priori conception of how it ought to unfold. And so with that, you know, notion of history, Kant wants to think about, for example, history of philosophy as the way he would put it is to say that history of philosophy or Geschichte of philosophy is a Geschichte of the self-development of reason. So Kant could construct, right, a priori, a vision of how history of philosophy ought to look like just by looking at the concept of reason. So he would do that step first and then use that a priori framework to look at, you know, what's going on, right, in the historical records. And then he would use, you know, he would say that philosophers like Plato and Aristotle, right, in ancient time, and Locke and Leibniz in the modern times, they were just means by which reason unfolds itself. And of course, that story would end with Kant's critical philosophy, right? So that was how Kant would tell the history of philosophy. And that itself is a very radical and, of course, extremely controversial move. And then at the same time, right, there was this also this question about, so who could serve as the means of history, the means by which reason develops itself over time? And this is where Kant's racist view becomes relevant, right? Because he would say, well, all these so-called non-white races, and especially Kant in this regard would single out East Indians, right? Because they were very much talked about as, you know, source of origin of philosophy. So Kant would say, well, this particular race, you know, they kind of started, you know, they had some kind of form of culture and they started before the Westerners did in some form of, you know, civilizing attempts, but they lacked a crucial capacity that disqualified them from doing proper philosophy and from doing science, strictly speaking. So this capacity is the capacity to think in abstract terms. So Kant himself could see, right, from his own perspective, that only the white Westerners have the capacity to philosophize at all. So he could conclude that history of philosophy could only have started with the Greeks because nobody else had the capacity to do so. And so Kant would say, you know, for example, you know, what say Confucius was doing was not proper moral philosophy, was some kind of ethical thinking, but was not proper philosophy. So he would then find a way to dismiss whatever the non-Westerners were doing as non-philosophy. Now, depending on who you talk to today, there are, I think, still quite a few professional philosophers who would say exactly that, right? They would say, well, you know, the Chinese, the Indians, and all those people have fascinating, you know, intellectual traditions, but they were not really, you know, philosophical enterprise, right? So they could not be qualified as philosophy proper. Yeah, they're kind of like spiritual, religious, or whatever. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm pulling from your book here to riff on that a bit. But as you argue there, it's not only about the ideal of reason and who gets to count as the ideal reasoner, but also about how that manifests in the form we think philosophy is supposed to take, particularly sort of the reifying of the argumentative structure at the expense of taking seriously many other forms of writing which express philosophical ideas just in a different way. That really jumped out to me in the book, that this emphasis on reason leads to a preoccupation with a particular kind of argumentative form as the preeminent form of philosophy.
Okay, so that's actually a great point you're adding. Now, the question people might ask is like, okay, so what do we do now, right? One response would be an assimilation model, right? Was that, you know, along that line, you would look really, really hard in other traditions for something that looks like philosophy as we know it, right? I find that approach really problematic. I think what we need to question here is a particular way of knowing and then pretending that this is something that ought to be universal. And if you're thinking at all, you have to think this way. If you are philosophizing at all, you have to philosophize this way. So if I find something that looks like what I do in your tradition, then great, that's a philosophy. If I don't, then, well, that's something else. I think that's really problematic. I think at this point, we need to think really honestly about how we are defining philosophy. I'm not rejecting, right, this Western way of defining philosophy offhand. I just want us to take a step back and ask ourselves how we got it and whether it's a something that we are entitled to impose on other philosophical traditions and use it to measure other materials.
So in a variety of ways now, we have spoken about the various challenges that come with doing this kind of work. But I now wanted to give you an opportunity to talk instead about the joys of this work. What have been the best parts of it for you?
Yeah, great. I think that's a really important question because I think it's really important to think about the joy in doing difficult work. And this work is not just intellectually challenging, as you indicated earlier, because, you know, the topic raised pulls so many strings in Kant's system, if you look carefully, right? And also it requires quite a bit of background knowledge about what else was going on in the 17th and 18th centuries. And some of that material is really hard to read, right? If you have to read about colonialism, colonial violence, and about slavery, it's emotionally difficult work. And also, as I mentioned earlier, you know, I'm a woman of Chinese descent, and it's not easy. I would be lying to say like I could just like read, right, some of these passages without feeling anything, right? It's not easy to see your own so-called race being repeatedly denigrated, and it does something to you emotionally. And so I had to do a lot of emotional work. And that's also, oddly, that's actually also where joy came in, because the best, I would say, the best piece of advice I received early on when I was working on this book was from Helga Varden, a Kant scholar who I admire. I asked her what I should do in order to sustain emotionally difficult work like this. And she said, find where all the good people are and keep them close. And I did exactly that. And I basically just looked around and I wanted to see where all the good people are who would be supportive of my project. And they may disagree with my specific interpretations, but they don't dismiss the value of this project. So in the process, I really did come across really fascinating, great people. They provided a lot of moral support. And I actually started an email folder, created an email folder entitled Good People to Keep Around. And I still have this folder and it keeps growing. And every time I actually open it, you know, once a while, and every time I look at it, I smile and I feel energized to keep doing this kind of work. And I also want to say that another source of joy is just to see, especially younger scholars who feel like now they have a different way of reading Kant and in a way that speaks to their values a lot more faithfully. And I think it's actually important to recognize, for me, it's a source of pleasure for me to recognize that this project goes beyond me. And I try my best to support some of these scholars. And I realize just how important it is to build a community to support scholars who are interested in doing this kind of work. Again, not just because it's intellectually challenging, but especially because it's emotionally challenging. I believe that you have to do this kind of work with the support, the moral support from others. So yeah, that's a joyous thing to do.
I love that. And I'm so glad you said it too, because it so nicely encapsulates so many of the things we've talked about, you know, both our starting point of what it means to occupy a view from somewhere, a particular perspective, but also just different mm-hmm. ways of practicing and doing philosophy that mm-hmm. we were taught, right? Like mm-hmm. philosophical work is so paradigmatically individualistic. Mm-hmm. The mm-hmm. stereotype of one mind alone in a room mm-hmm. thinking through an idea just like super hard. Mm-hmm. And that model is, it's not only mentally taxing, but as you say, right, emotionally taxing. Obviously, mm-hmm. the emotional labor that is involved in reading about your own race being denigrated is different mm-hmm. in kind from the emotional work of working through a difficult argument. Mm-hmm. But in both cases, you know, you can so clearly benefit from a community.
Yes.
And I really like the idea that in writing this book, not only were you describing and modeling
yeah,
different great. Ways of doing philosophy, but you're also practicing them. That was such an important part of putting it together.
Thank you.
So on that note, let me just end by asking you about your plans for future work. What do you have in the pipeline that you'd like to talk about, whether it be on Kant or on any other topic?
Oh, well, I'm not done with Kant yet. So I like I said earlier, the kind of Kant I'm finding fascinating is the non-ideal Kant. So I want to explore with others. I really appreciate that you highlighted the point about community, about how not to pretend as though we could do philosophy on our own. So I would like to explore with other scholars who are interested, right, ways of doing Kant that pay very close attention to non-ideal conditions of philosophizing, and of just like, you know, of being. We live, you know, in non-ideal conditions, and what it means to do a non-ideal Kant. So that's a kind of like bigger framework I'll be approaching my next projects. I have a couple more book projects that I'm plotting. One may be a very small book on Kant's theory of abstraction, which is actually not, surprisingly, not so well understood by Kant scholars. I think we need to understand where abstraction shows up in Kant's methodology. And I think that's actually connected to the kind of non-ideal work I want to do, because what Kant often was abstracting from were the non-ideal conditions. But then it's also important to recognize that he does not stop there, right? He would go then, you know, go back down to the concrete level and look at the non-ideal conditions and try to model the non-ideal world and to see how it's relevant to his ideal theorizing. So that might be a small book project I'll work on. And then I'll have a bigger project. I will try to look at enlightenment differently by using Kant as a case study. So the tentative title of that book is going to be Kant and the Enlightenment's Other. You can see like this can be a sequel to the book on race, because that's not the whole picture, right? I haven't said anything about what Kant said about Judaism, for example, right? And I did not incorporate Kant's views on women. And I'm also very interested in Kant's construction of masculinity, for example. And so this allows me to take a closer look at how the Enlightenment has been understood. And so we may get a more complex picture of the Enlightenment itself by looking at the different movements by which the non-European, non-white, and non-Christian, right, non-male other was constructed. And I think Kant, precisely because he was so attentive to what was going on in his time, could provide a perfect window into all these other dimensions of the Enlightenment. So that's the other bigger book project.
Well, I very much look forward to seeing that work. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. I had a wonderful time reading your book and an even better time getting to talk to you about it.
Thank you, Haley. This has been a great pleasure.
Thank you for listening to New Voices. Production of the podcast is funded by the Social Science and Humanities Research Council of Canada as part of the Extending New Narratives in the History of Philosophy project.
The music you hear is 17th century female composer Elizabeth Claude Jacquet de la Guerre's Sonata No. 2 in D major, performed on the violin by Pizzeria Armonici. For more information about the project and for future episodes, please visit our website, newnarrativesinphilosophy.net.
New Voices is a continuation of the New Narratives in the History of Philosophy podcast. You can also find past episodes under that name in all the same places.
We look forward to discussing all these new figures and ideas with you.